This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Toni Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Eli, today we have a very special guest.
Yes.
Dr. Indira Etwaru, the new CEO and artistic director of the Harlem Stage. She recently returned to New York City from California. She was leading the Steve Jobs Performing Arts Center. I think it's in Cupertino, California. Am I correct?
It's Cupertino, the Steve Jobs Theater.
Yes, Steve Jobs Theater. And before that, she was at the award-winning Billie Holiday Theater. That's where we met, and I got a taste of Indira's genius. And you also were at the Jerome L. Green Space for a period of time, and you were at BAM. So now you are back in New York City. We're so happy to see you. So what was it like in Cali, okay? What was the cultural vibe? What was that? What was it like?
You know, California has the most beautiful weather. But when you come from the cultural capital of the world, that is New York City, nothing can compare. And so it is a thrill to be back home.
Excellent. And when we spoke earlier, we were talking about something that you feel is so important. It had to do with the creative and then thrivability. This idea of the intersectionality between infrastructure and the creative process, because at the Harlem, is it the Harlem Stage or Harlem Stage?
Harlem Stage.
At Harlem Stage, you are the CEO and the artistic director. That doesn't happen too frequently. Talk to us about what that is and how you're going to manage that.
Yeah, thank you, Toni. Well, first of all, let me just say I love the opportunity to sit with you, of course, and Eli. It's always so illuminating and a time for just great reflection. And you know, I think when I think about thrivability and creativity or artistry, they're at their best when they intersect. And it's so important to understand why that's important for institutions of color, why it's so important for those of us who are leading institutions that are in service to the global majority, because there's centuries of disinvestments in our communities and centuries of inequitable investments in our communities. So in the 1950s and 1960s, so many arts institutions came out of the Black Arts Movement, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement. 500 to 600 theaters, Black theaters, actually opened during that time. In the 1990s, 87% of those theaters closed their doors because of the disinvestment from the national and federal administration. And in 2017, the Helicon Collaborative put forward what we had known all along, those of us who have worked with and or led predominant institutions of color. And that's that there is a very unequal playing field. In fact, so unequal that 96% of dollars go outside of institutions of color that are not focused on social justice. 4% of philanthropic dollars are going to institutions that are focused on indigenous, Latin, African-American, or Black diaspora and Asian. And that is 4% of those communities.
Though, right?
This is nationwide.
Angry.
It makes me, you know, it actually drives me. It's actually the thing that makes me wake up every morning and, you know, get ready to start and start the work on the battlefield again to really figure out how we can bring artistry together and the business acumen side to create thrivability for communities and for artists. And what we do know is that the models that have been in place have not led us towards that thrivability, which means we've got to start thinking about new models. And so I think leaders really do have to come at institution building, both from the artistic point of view, but also what creates thrivability.
Is it a priority when we're talking a lot about disinvestment, right? And underinvestment, that would seem to mean that it's just not prioritized.
Well, I would say that yes, it's not prioritized, and the murder of George Floyd ushered it into an international and national conversation, and manifestos were coming into being from every arts organization and every philanthropic organization. And I will use this moment as a call to arms that cultural institutions and philanthropic institutions have to stay the course. This is not the time to pivot. This is not the time to look for the next cool thing. Racial investments in organizations of color has everything to do with how healthy our democracy is, how able we are to build a civilization in which equity is at the forefront. I'm often reminded of a quote, and forgive me because I can't remember who said it, but for those who have experienced privilege, then equity starts to feel like oppression. And I think within the philanthropic world, for institutions who are accustomed to that 96% of dollars,
right,
and then we start recalibrating towards equity, it starts feeling like they're being disinvested in, right? And so there's some conversations that we as a field are going to have to be very brave and are going to have difficult dialogues with dignity.
So where are these conversations taking place? Are there association meetings, or is this across other directors of institutions like yours, or?
I do think that people are having these conversations.
Right?
I think they're starting to, and yeah. I think the last 4 years have ushered them in. For sure, there's still kitchen table talks, right? So that's intra within the field. Institutions of color, we're having them amongst ourselves. We need to start having them across the aisles. We need to start having them in more open spaces. And I think, you know, Cornel West said something to me when I first started at the Green Space. And he said to me, my generation was polite. Your generation doesn't need to be as polite and worry so much about the feelings of those who are in power.
I can sometimes be polite, and it's not.
And it's generational, right?
It is. It's how you got ahead.
The generation behind me, they don't even worry about diplomacy or politeness at all, right? And so I think there's a courage and there's a sort of speaking truth to power that's being ushered in by this next generation that I think is absolutely necessary. But I also think I would caution this next generation to also exercise wisdom.
Yes.
And the wisdom of doing the research, understanding the history, understanding how to build partnerships and not burn down bridges all at the same time.
Stuff that usually doesn't fit 140 characters.
Doesn't fit into 140 characters for sure, Eli.
But you also say something interesting about this dynamic, and there's a myth about the arts, if you will, the archetypes, you know, the sort of the lonely genius off of the addict, no care for practicality, when in fact it's not really the case. Of course, you look at some of the most successful artists, they had that kind of duality. They had the infrastructure piece and they also had the creative piece of it.
That's right.
So, but in some ways, if we go back to the Harlem stage, so you're, one of the things you're working with this idea of like combining the creative aspect to it. And so how else were you looking to help support the kind of programs and new things that you're doing now?
Yeah.
Or planning to do?
Sure. I've heard from folks that Harlem Stage is one of the best kept secrets in Harlem, right, which is sort of exciting, right? Because that's an opportunity.
But also hateful in a way, because like, why is it a secret?
Like, what? Yeah, but it's such an incredible organization. Camille Brown, for example, danced at Harlem Stage before anyone even knew who Camille Brown was 20 years ago.
I agree with
and
you
that's
around
the
that, because
brilliance,
a lot of folks didn't know.
Right?
It's
the brilliance
a secret
of her.
In some respects,
and,
yes.
And now she's a multi-Tony Award-nominated artist who's the most sought-after choreographer. And so that's the brilliance of Harlem Stage. It has been fearless. It has done adventurous work. And so for me, it's exciting because I enter the role as CEO and artistic director with a megaphone. And so part of infrastructure building is storytelling. And how do we tell that story in a way that is compelling and that reverberates beyond Harlem? I am not going to share it yet. I'm going to leave that for our marketing department to announce in the fall. But we've got some very exciting things up our sleeves for how to really start making sure that tree is not falling in the forest and no one can hear it.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking with the visionary Dr. Indira Atwaru. Now, I've known you to really push the boundaries when it comes to storytelling, meaning I think you used to talk about taking the audience to where they don't even know they want to go. Something of that nature. How do you balance what the audience can stand or take or what they're into versus what you think they might need to hear? That kind of thing. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, I love that. And that's actually what Wynton Marsalis shared with me when I was launching the Green Space.
Yes,
when I was launching the Green Space, Indira, take audiences where they don't even know they want to go. And I just have held fast to that since I launched that in 2009.
See, I held fast to it, too.
Yeah, it's so brilliant. And I, you know, it's funny because I don't think of it as boundary breaking. Mm-hmm. I actually don't see boundaries. Mm-hmm. I don't even see them. I think about the audience. A lot of the work that I do is thinking about the privilege. It is such a privilege to be able to tell the stories of people of color. Mm-hmm. They are the unstitched fabric of American society, and in fact, in many ways, remain the moral compass for this country and the world. A people who have been so disinvested in, a people who have endured so much and so much oppression, and yet we continue to show up with this triumph of the human
spirit.
The resiliency, right? and the genius, mm-hmm. you know, Black genius and Indigenous genius and Latin genius, it's in Asian genius, it's shaped the entire planet. So for me, it's about how do I honor those stories, and we are never short on stories. We are never short. There's inspiration everywhere. So for me, I'm just trying to keep my eyes open and my ears open and look for that spark and provide artists a platform to have that moment of sparking an idea that leads towards a new work and a new world. And so I will share that the North Star that I am using for Harlem Stage, and it's becoming the mantra for the team, is that Harlem is our home, but the world is our stage. And so art can happen anywhere.
But don't you think in some ways that you also have to, especially working with people who create these kind of narratives and pieces, if you will, that it gets to a point where it's so adventurous that you almost lose harmonic resonance with the people who have to view it because it's almost too far out there? Do you find that, or is that not the case?
I really love that question. And you know, I think that's what the avant-garde era really struggled with. But I've learned that when something is so specific, it resonates universally. Some of the most powerful art comes from, you know, walks of life that I've never walked. But because it's so specific, there are what it means to be human stories that translate across time and space. So I think it's less about, it's not accessible. I think when an artist is able to be vulnerable and honest and share something of the human experience from a place that is so pure, it does resonate universally.
It's almost like the best stuff comes in from your peripheral vision.
Absolutely, you know what I mean? You know, and when that artist is able to be in a safe space to open their hearts and their souls and offer that up to us as an humble offering, it does have the transformative power to change the world.
And that's the thing that I so believe. But then you've got those who are paying the philanthropists. They want to know the impact, right? How does one say what this means or what this is worth? Well, how does one do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I'm speaking methodology, Tony, I would say we've relied so much on the quantitative, mm-hmm. the metrics, the number of people in seats, the impressions, the visitors, the likes, the ticket sales. But the qualitative is about planting seeds that we may never see grow.
Right.
Right. Because I know you shared with me a story about a young woman whose life was changed by one of your interviews.
Yes.
And I think to myself, well, isn't that enough?
Isn't it?
Isn't that enough?
Isn't it?
I think it is.
We live in a society where sometimes it's not enough, but I think it is enough.
I think it is. I do too. I think it is. I think when one woman can impact the life of another woman, my God, isn't that a testament to the power and transformative power of the work that we do? And I think if we can combine the qualitative and the quantitative, then we're on to something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
In some ways, it impacts couple hundred people going generations forward because
for sure.
It's not just one person.
The viral effect, right? Yeah, right. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, you mentioned this.
Now I want to get into some of your superpowers as a leader. What's the superpower or superpowers, if you want to call them that, or the traits or the characteristics?
Yeah, I think my older sister is so good at reflecting back to me who I've always been and saying to me, like, one of my superpowers is being oblivious.
That's like a must.
I'm sort of oblivious. She'll say, oh my God, you've done this and this and this, but you're so oblivious to it. Your head is down and you're just doing the work. And I think, okay, maybe that is a superpower. And then another one is I do feel very humbled in the work. I feel so grateful and so humbled that I get to do this work, because I do know that most of the women walking the planet who are of color and are women aren't educated. They don't have the opportunity to be educated. They are carrying buckets of water for villages as their life's work or things of that nature. And they're dealing with oppression that I can't even imagine. So it really does humble me that I was a woman of color, a Black woman born in America, mm-hmm. where I was able to be educated. And as my mother used to say, to whom much is given, much is required. And so that I think a superpower is I believe that because of what I've been given, much is required of me. And then another superpower, which is kind of a weird one, is I really don't care what people think about me. I just
so
don't
powerful.
Care. I don't care. And I've never,
yes.
even since I was a little girl, and I would, this is a weird thing, but like my mother would be chasing me to brush my hair because I hated having my hair brushed, and say, you can't go to church like that. What are people going to say? And I'm like, I don't care.
But I tell you, I got in so much trouble in school for that.
Right, but
it's worth it.
I think it's important because I think the moment we give people the right to praise us or even critique us, and that matters to us, and it matters to how we show up in the world, that's a power we're giving away.
Amen.
And I just think that it's something we've been talking a lot about at Harlem Stage and what artistic freedom really means. And that's a part of our vision, and our mission statement is artistic freedom. And our incredible director, senior director of marketing, Deirdre May, it's actually language that she came up with, and she kind of really drilled down and got to the pulse of who we are. And it, when I looked it up, what freedom actually means, it means one who is completely unencumbered by the restrictions or judgment of another. And I thought, there's not a lot of art happening that's unencumbered by the restrictions or judgment of another. And isn't that something to strive for?
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And Dr. Indira Atwar will never disappoint. She's always, you give so much. This is really touching me on so many levels, especially the piece around just don't care about what other people think. How's that? But a difficult place to sometimes come to, because there's always some string attached. There might be string attached to the dollars, or string attached to a family member, or string attached.
You know, I was going to say, I think that has to, that not caring what people think needs to be rooted in integrity.
Thank you.
And
yes.
honesty. And because we know of leaders who don't care what people think.
And they just do.
And they're just doing
whatever.
And
there's a name for those.
And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm really talking about, you know, standing in what feels like an authentic truth for oneself. Mm-hmm. And standing. Even if you're standing alone, you know that there is an authentic voice within you that is guiding and leading and really rooting that in values that go far deeper than the immediate.
You were talking about Black women all over the world and something that I'm not thinking about when you were in Ethiopia. You got to see how women who are living in dire poverty don't have the basic necessities of life. Can you talk to us about just a little bit about that piece of your life, Ethiopia? I'll never forget the story you told me about your infant daughter at the time and how you were there on a Fulbright scholarship. I'll let you tell the story, but I think I never forgot it.
Yeah.
I never forgot that story.
I think probably one of the highlights of my life. And, you know, I received this Fulbright Scholar Award, and I was pregnant with my daughter and wasn't sure if I was going to go. And Dr. Kariamu Welsh Asante, who she and her husband founded the first PhD program in African American Studies at Temple University, and I studied under her. And she said, healthy babies are being born and raised every day in Africa. So I thought, oh, I can still go. And so I took my six-month-old baby with me, and we lived amongst and worked with refugee Somali women. So they were urban refugees who had fled Mogadishu, the 1991 conflict, Mogadishu-Somali, and come to Ethiopia, Addis, the capital city. So I was there for a little over a year, and I was so blown away by the brilliance of these women. They spoke multiple languages, French and Arabic and Somali and Amharic, but in the West, they were considered uneducated because they weren't literate in terms of reading or writing in their native tongue or in any tongue. But they were just, they were businesswomen, they were entrepreneurs, they spoke multiple languages. It was a brilliance that I've, you know, since learned to understand very deeply and to celebrate. Very much changed my worldview.
So you left the Steve Jobs Theater. What's the why? Why did you leave and come back? That was the question.
So I give away the answer.
That's it. And I love the opportunity to share it. So thank you both for that. Thank you, Eli. And thank you, Tony. Yeah, my daughter, since she was 6 months old, has gone to Ethiopia or NPR or Brooklyn or, I mean, she's gone everywhere for me to figure out ways to be in service to communities of color. She's a recent graduate of the Theater Conservatory at Purchase. And so when she decided to make New York her home, I decided that it was my turn to center her in my life the way she centered me and to just be here to support her so that we're not doing that, you know, back and forth across the country every other weekend. And so putting her at the center of my life feels like this is exactly what I want to be doing at this phase
in
my life.
Equally remarkable woman as you are.
What keeps you up at night, if anything does, around this the Harlem stage, this new project, this new passion, because it's clearly passion is in here.
Yeah. Nothing keeps me up at night anymore.
Okay.
I sleep really, really well.
So what is it? Yeah, where are you that nothing keeps you up?
Because,
that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
what is it?
I think
besides freedom and not caring,
yeah,
what else is in there?
I think I have figured out in a stillness that California ushered in.
It does do that to you.
Do want to hold on to. Mm-hmm. And while others have FOMO, the fear of missing out, I have JOMO, the joy of missing out,
I
don't need to be in the middle or the center, and putting others at the center is my next act. I think of this as my act too. COVID was this intermission. Apple was this sort of intermission away. And now I'm entering an act two, and it's all about the joy of centering other incredible human beings and letting them, you know, take off. It is really joy for me to watch people, younger people, people who are redefining themselves, you know, even if they're my age or older, and they're redefining themselves.
It happens all the time. Reimagining. You know?
It's not just younger.
No, it's not.
And right. It's exciting. And whatever I can do to be in service to that feels like the right place that I'm in. And there's an incredible peace in that.
You know, I remember my daughter went to a Quaker school. And they'd have an assembly, this thing where they spoke from silence. And to see these three-year-olds sitting on their hands, you know, because they want to jump around. But amazing what they came up with.
My babysitter, when we were three, after we'd be in kindergarten, and we'd have to come home, and she would have us listen to the still, small voice. She'd take each of us into the sitting room and say, now, I want you to hear the still, small voice in your heart. And I would hear this itty-bitty voice, and I was like, is that it? I wanted to be able to do that.
But your own voice internally, or is it somebody outside?
It was me.
I just want to clarify this.
But I think it is that when you're grounded in that, it's such a gift and a blessing.
It is a gift
and a blessing. To be grounded in it, where it makes you feel chosen in that sense. Now, let's talk about your spiritual practice, because we've spoken. We're not strangers to one another. Why don't you share what your practice is?
I am a woman of faith. I was raised as a woman of faith by a woman of faith. I stand firmly when I think of faith as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. And I do think that I have the gift of manifestation, that I can focus energy and harness energy to manifest things, not on my behalf, but on behalf of an organization, on behalf of a community of people. It has been a privilege to be able to channel that faith on behalf of something far greater than myself.
You know, and I just think that that's incredible, because that is the lesson, to understand that that power is within you, especially when you're a conduit. It gets a little tough when you're hoarding for yourself, but when you pray to the universe and say, I want to be able to help others, it shows up. Because that's what I feel it wants us to do.
I agree, Tony.
Yeah, I was going to add to that is that there's also an element that you're really present to your authenticity, and which is kind of funny thing about humans, because they don't know they only exist in the present. You know what I mean? but we want to really thank you for this amazing interview. We knew it was going to be great.
Thank you both.
It blows my mind. So I'm sure you're going to do some amazing thing. Have you done in your previous careers at the Harlem Stage? And we're really looking forward to it, and we want to be at the openings as well.
Yes.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Art Moves. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Art Moves with a Z. You can listen to Art Moves on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Bricks Arts Media and recorded at Bricks Studio in downtown Brooklyn. I'm Ilya Koslansky.
I'm Tony Williams.
And until next time, keep exploring, keep creating, find some art that moves you, and share it.